Good evening and welcome. It's KBC Arts. Arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, it's Natalia Estrada in conversation with Justin Freer conducting the music of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. That's at the Hollywood Bowl July 6th. I'll be speaking with Maurice Williams. Maurice Williams and the Zodiacs are part of an all-star lineup with The Legends of Doo-Wop Volume 2. That's coming to Upland July 16th. That concert also includes Eugene Pitt from the Jive 5, Jimmy Stevens of the Safaris, J.T. Carter, founder of the Crests, also Shirley Alston Reeves from the Shirelles. We're going to start with Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with an author that gives us a world of science fiction in the 11th book chronicling the adventures of an elite soldier rescue team, the Sigma Force.
Our guest today is best-selling author James Rollins. He's here to talk about his new book, The Bone Labyrinth. Thank you for joining us today, James.
Thanks, Emmanuel. Appreciate it.
You're more than welcome. I am glad to have you here. I am a science fiction fan, but I have to admit to you that I'm learning a lot about your works through this book, The Bone Labyrinth, and your other works. Now, James, The Bone Labyrinth is the latest in a series of books you've written about everything from history to technology, past, present, and future. How many Sigma Force novels have you written?
This is number 11.
Number 11.
Not that you have to read them in that order. I think 90% of my readers have not read my books in order. I think they jump in wherever they happen to be caught by the cover or whatnot and fill in the blanks from there.
Before we get to The Bone Labyrinth, will you tell us a bit about some of the titles, Black Order, The Judas Strain, and I'm really interested in The Sixth Extinction.
Right, that was the book just prior to this. Sixth Extinction deals with a real scientific concept. Probably saw a few headlines about this, that it seems like right now we're at the cusp of heading into a sixth mass extinction on this planet. There's been five mass extinctions in the past, and the sixth one, it seems to be looming right now, and there's different strategies on how to maybe circumvent that, and this novel sort of tackles those strategies and how they sometimes come into collision with each other and how that can lead to catastrophes.
Now, how did the other five extinctions come about?
Well, some of them were things like the destruction of the weapon of the dinosaur from the collision of an asteroid, but there's other events that occurred also. Probably the most significant event was the third extinction, which wiped out most life down to there was only like 10% of life on the planet was left. 90% of all life on the planet was wiped out, which is a good thing in that the planet seems to be resilient at coming back. Unfortunately, it's oftentimes when that happens, the dominant life form vanishes. One time the dinosaurs, and this time it might be us.
Now, the Doomsday Key and the Judas Strain. Now, the Judas Strain is something I am familiar with. Will you talk about that one a little bit?
Yeah, the Judas Strain deals with sort of a scary concept that something could get loose that we aren't prepared for. We know we saw it with the Spanish influenza that wiped out 200,000 plus lives. We saw it with the Black Plague. I talked to the FBI directorate about that risk, and right now there are like in garages, there's little bio labs being set up around the country because the cost of doing genetic research has come very cheap. This new technique called CRISPR-Cas, it allows you to pluck out DNA and replant it with amazing precision and with very little cost. And to operate that system requires nothing more than a simple biology degree. And so what we're finding now is that in some of these backlog labs, they're creating new forms of life, they're patenting life, but there's no restriction. When I just talked to the FBI, they're concerned that something might get loose from one of these labs, and I asked them about regulation of those labs, and he said, well, we depend upon self-policing.
Oh.
Which is a disconcerting thought.
Yes, it is. It really is. With the things that we know that we work with in this country and around the world, wow, self-policing.
Exactly. It's disturbing. And it's on some of these different, I won't say the dark websites, but sites that are a little questionable. And there was some gentlemen that were proposing releasing some of these genetically modified organisms into the wild. And literally, this was what they said, just to see what might happen.
Okay. So,
that keeps me up at night a little bit.
It should. Would you mind sending some of those guys some of your books so they could at least get an idea what could happen? Because you would think they would know by now. So, okay, let's get back to The Bone Labyrinth because this is a very interesting book. And, wow, it has a lot of intrigue. It has a lot of twists and turns that I'm still trying to keep up with even as we talk. So what is The Bone Labyrinth about?
Well, it starts when twin sisters, they're both geneticists, and they're attacked on two different continents. The first one's assaulted in Europe while investigating the discovery of a medieval chapel that's found buried in an underground cavern in the mountains of Croatia. And they find in that chapel the bones of a Neanderthal woman. The other is abducted from a primate research center outside of Atlanta, and she's kidnapped along with a young sign language speaking gorilla, who also has a unique genetic secret himself. Sigma Force, our sort of team of heroes, is called in to rescue the two women and find out what was going on. And in doing so, they expose a Chinese plot to genetically alter human embryos, which is sort of from the headlines. That is something that just came out recently, that there was a Chinese scientist that were experimenting with altering the DNA of human embryos. And this book tackles that very subject matter.
I'm Emmanuel Rogers, speaking with James Rollins, author of The Bone Labyrinth. Now, where I started off, I was about 38,000 years B.C.
I like to start early.
Yeah. So I met a few of the Neanderthals.
The story starts, you know, about 50,000 years ago or so, but it's based upon a true anthropological mystery. We do know for the past 200,000 years that the human brains have been roughly the same size, shape, anatomy. But then about 50,000 years ago, for some unknown reason, there was a sudden spike in art, ingenuity, weapon development, the production of grave goods, civilization in general. And this moment in time was given the name the Great Leap Forward. It's baffled most anthropologists, and that's the exact trigger, what caused that spike of human ingenuity. Now, the most accepted theory is this is about the time that early man began to migrate out of Africa and was being exposed to new lands, new challenges, and possibly required new innovations. And maybe that was the fire that stoked that Great Leap Forward. But there's different anthropologists have other theories. It might have been a diet change. It might have been the fact that an ice age was occurring. It was climatic change that triggered it. But in this book, I tackle another possibility that's just now being bandied about in the scientific world, and that's something from a genetic standpoint that might have changed right at that point in history.
Okay, now I won't go too much into that because I don't want to give the readers too much going here, but who is Gray Pierce and his team?
Well, Gray Pierce leads a unit of Sigma Force. Sigma Force is a group of special forces soldiers that have been recruited by DARPA, which is the Defense Department's Research and Development Wing. They are trained in various scientific disciplines, act as field operatives for DARPA. And basically, as I describe them, they're scientists with guns, for lack of a better term, and they protect us against various threats.
Okay. Now, is this team throughout the Sigma Force books?
It is. The series is based on a group, and I like doing the series based on a group because it allows me a couple things, that the jeopardy can come from very many different directions. Because it's a group, I can knock off the major characters, so everybody's in jeopardy because DARPA can always recruit a new member. It also allows me to shift my spotlight from one character to another so we can get maybe in more depth on this individual member of Sigma in this book and then swing that spotlight to another individual in the next book. So it sort of gives me a little bit of literary elbow room in which to keep the series active and exciting and not feel stale.
All right. Now, James, I'm going to deviate for just a moment here because you really seem to appreciate your fans. And I know it seems obvious that, okay, well, if I don't have the fans, you know, don't have the readers, I don't have a successful book. But you seem to really like them.
When I first started as a writer, my first book was published in 98. At that point, very few writers even had websites. I had my first sort of website. I was one of the first authors to have websites. And when Facebook came out, I was, you know, very excited about joining Facebook. I talked to my publisher, and I was saying, gosh, I would really like to get more involved. Is there anything you can help me with, you know, maybe designing? Because I'm not that great of a designer. And they said, no, don't bother with Facebook. You're just wasting your time. And I thought, I don't think so. Then later on at this point, they're now like, everybody needs to be on Facebook. But I enjoy that because, you know, writing's a solitary profession. I'm locked in my room 8, 9, 10 hours a day. And before, there was no other avenue besides the occasional once a year where they unhook the leash from my neck and I can run around and do a book tour.
Right.
And actually meet some people. But through Facebook, through Twitter, it allows me to have a communication with my readership that I not only do I appreciate just the social aspect of it, but oftentimes I love the feedback I get from readers. I like to get some of them send me some great ideas that I've incorporated and acknowledged in the front of the books. Even for this book, when I was getting feedback, they were saying, hey, you've got this one character in your Sigma universe, Joe Kowalski. And Joe Kowalski has been a bit of a lug, not the brightest bulb in the group.
Right.
And I recruited him actually from a standalone novel I'd written years prior, but I liked him so much. More of my comic relief. He's a support character, but most people wanted to know more about him. So I chose in this book to shift that spotlight I mentioned before onto Joe,
right,
shine it fully on him so we can actually get more about Joe, find out how he ticks, how his mind works. So again, it's nice getting that interplay between author and reader that we didn't have just 5, 10 years ago.
I think it helps because Joe actually is someone that a lot of us can identify with.
So. Right. I mean, everybody asks, you know, which of the Sigma members are you? And they expect me to say Gray Pierce. But I said, no, I'm probably more like Joe. I'm the one that's going to get in trouble. I'm going to do the wrong thing. I'm going to push the wrong button. I'm going to say the wrong thing.
Right. And there goes the earth again.
Exactly.
Now, I have to ask you, because we have some dark and shadowy figures in this book, Does this story end on planet Earth?
It does. Even though it seems like we're going to be heading somewhere strange, the whole book is founded firmly in science, and we're going to take you right to the edge and make you peer over the edge and think of what might come. But no, we're basically at the end of the book. You are firmly on terra firma.
Now, James, what is something about the Bone Labyrinth that you would like to speak on?
Well, the book is, besides a big roller coaster of an adventure, I always, you know, think for a book to have good resonance with the reader, that when you turn the last page and you close the book, that you're hopefully left with something to think about. At the end of the book, I have sort of what's true and what's not section where I pull the curtains aside and let you know where some of the details of the book came from. And one of the things this probably goes to my veterinary background. I introduce a new character here, Baco. He's a 3-year-old mountain gorilla that's got an unusual genetic history.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote scenes from Baco's point of view, sort of to get an idea of what it feels like to be in the paws of that animal, for several reasons, both to sort of get an idea how gorillas think, what their emotional levels are, how intelligent they are, while at the same time we explore some of the research, medical research that's been done on great apes. You know, most of the Western world, research is banned, if not tightly restricted, in most of those countries, except the U.S. When I was writing this book, there really was no ban on great ape research. But as of last September, just a couple months ago, the National Institute of Health just announced that they're banning research on chimpanzees, which I think is a great step forward. You know, it's not as far as I'd like to see that go, but it's a step in the right direction.
Wow, that's actually amazing. They've been talking about this for many decades, and it's just now being pushed through?
Exactly.
Well, now, I don't want to get off subject, but you seem to know something about this. Is using these animals necessary?
Well, they are a close model for humans, so I can see why it made sense to use them as medical models. But, you know, these creatures they understand past, present, and future. They have rich emotional lives. So to use them in these manners is, I think, quite cruel. And most of the time, a lot of these tests are unproductive or repetitive, and often just unnecessary. So I'm glad to see that these are being discontinued.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Okay, back to the Bone Labyrinth. Our time is just about up, James, but I want to know, what's next for you? Do you have a new novel, or can we hope to see the Bone Labyrinth made into a movie soon? What's going on?
Well, the Sigma series has been optioned. Finally signed full contract, so the entire series is under option. They're converting the first book into a screenplay right now. So, you know, hopefully shortly down the line, we might see them on the big screen. But coming up next spring is Warhawk. It's a book featuring a pair of characters that came out of Sigma. That's Captain Tucker Wayne and his military war dog, Kane. And again, in that book, I get to write scenes from the military war dog's perspective, so you get an understanding of how those 4-legged soldiers operate and function.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I really hope they make all of them into movies. This is an interesting series, especially for those who love science fiction, science history. So you have pretty much everything for a lot of people that like to read.
I hope they try it out. My goal is to keep your heart pounding and turning pages late into the night, but hopefully after you turn that last page, I have left you something to think about.
That was author James Rollins in conversation with Emmanuel Rogers. His latest book, The Bone Labyrinth, can be found at many online retailers, as well as at the author's website, jamesrollins.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online at kvcrnews.org. Just ahead, it's the Symphony, with Justin Freer conducting the music of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. That's at the Hollywood Bowl July 6th. Also doo-wop with Maurice Williams and the Zodiacs.
Hello, I'm Isabella Salinas, and happy 4th of July. Well, happy early 4th of July. If you're having trouble finding out what to do on that day, here's some cool activities you can go look at, like Apple Valley's fireworks at the Lenny Brewster Sports Center. Festivities include live entertainment, games, food booths, a beer garden, and fireworks. Parking and admission is free. For more information, go to applevalley.org. Then in Chino Hills, there's the old-fashioned 4th of July picnic at Big League Dreams Sports Park. Enjoy water activities, live entertainment, food contests, food vendors, game booths, crafts, BMX stunt shows, rock climbing, and more. For more information, visit chinohills.org. And if you're looking to play some baseball, head down to 280 South East Street in San Bernardino and watch a baseball game. Then stay after to watch some fireworks. Game starts at 7:05 p.m. Then after is the fireworks. Thank you for listening. This is 91.9 KVCR.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Coming up soon in Upland, The Legends of Doo-Wop Volume 2. Eugene Pitt from the Jive 5, Jimmy Stevens of the Safaris, Shirley Alston Reeves from the Shirelles, J.T. Carter, founder of the Crests, and Maurice Williams in the Zodiacs. I'll be speaking with Maurice in just a bit. First, though, it's Natalia Estrada in conversation with composer and conductor Justin Freer, conducting the music of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. That's at the Hollywood Bowl July 6th.
So tell me about the first ever Harry Potter film concert series.
Well, if we can imagine, you know, how many years have gone by since this wonderful franchise has come to development. I mean, you know, first with the books and then with the films, and, you know, we have theme parks now and this wonderful stage show in London, and here we are with a wonderful, beautiful opportunity to celebrate these films and these music scores by these composers in a very visceral, very realistic way, in a way that has never yet been available to audiences, so that we can now experience the score to the film in a live setting, you know, with an 85-piece orchestra breathing life into the movie, is a very, very unique, rather special opportunity.
What made you want to take this project on? I mean, it's a huge franchise and a huge project, and fans of this Harry Potter series are just incredible. What made you want to take on something so iconic?
Well, the world over certainly loves Harry Potter, and, you know, the first film, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, really started it off in an incredibly magical, adventurous way. And beyond just the film itself, I've been passionate about the music since the first time I ever heard John Williams compose that first score. And with John's music, we are able to experience the magical qualities, the emotional qualities of the characters, you know, the adventure that these children embark upon at the Hogwarts school, and all of these things that come along with this amazing story that J.K. Rowling has created for us. John's music for this particular film is something that we all admire, and what a wonderful opportunity to preserve and present this art form in this manner. I think that these films, these scores, they really do deserve to be preserved and presented this way, because they are, you know, one of the great sets of art that we have in our literature.
Could you tell me about the first time you kind of heard that first little set of music from this film and what it felt like?
Well, I felt like I was a kid again, and it actually kind of was still fairly young. I mean, I was a teenager when I first heard, you know, these original notes by John Williams to the Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, the first film. And I remember feeling very much so that I was given an opportunity to escape into this universe. And I think that's what great film and great music does. It helps us. We're presented with an opportunity for escapism. And I think that's what one of the great qualities of these films, and certainly these scores. And it, right away from the first note, you're transported into Harry's universe. And I think that with these magical notes that John created, in fact, you know, from what I understand, but what it became, Hedwig's theme, was actually written before he ever saw a frame of the film. It was written sight unseen, as he describes it, as John Williams describes it. Mm-hmm. And so one of the great themes that we now know from the Harry Potter universe musically, John wrote as Hedwig's theme for this beautiful celesta instrument before the film was ever shown to him.
That's incredible. So did he read the books before that?
I don't want to speak to that because I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I know that he has read the books, but I don't know if he had read the books, all of the books at that point. I know that he was excited about being part of this project. Whether or not he had read all of the books at that time, I just don't know. But it certainly seems like it. He had a wonderful window into this universe before he even saw a frame of the film. So I imagine that he at least knew something about it. You know, whether or not he read the books, I'm not quite sure.
Well, the first film, The Sorcerer's Stone, it kind of introduces us into this whole universe and everything. How is the concert going to expand on that?
Well, one of the things that sets this opportunity, aside from all the others that are Harry Potter related, is the very unique opportunity that we now have to experience these music scores in their entirety in a live setting. It's something that you truly have to see to believe. And in that way, it's a very immersive experience, because now all of a sudden you have 85, 90, in some cases 95 players breathing life into this film in a very visceral way. And so now this becomes much more of a shared experience, whereas, you know, when you're in a movie theater, you're surrounded by hundreds of people, and what a wonderful opportunity that is just by itself in a darkened room. But then imagine being surrounded by, in some cases, 17,000 people, like the Hollywood Bowl, or 5,000 people in Royal Albert Hall, or 12,000 people at the Mann Center. I can list so many different venues around the world that give us an opportunity, regardless of the project or regardless of the concert, to experience music in a very shared way. And that's one of the unique things, I think, with this project, is now we have this beloved franchise, this beloved characters, this wonderful music score by John Williams that is admired throughout the world, you know, by musicians and beyond. And now all of a sudden, we can watch and hear and feel physically the excitement of this music coming right at our faces from the stage while it's synchronized in real time to the film. There's nothing like it.
So do you think a lot of people coming to see this show are going to be dressed up? How excited are you to see people?
As far as my excitement for the patrons, that's one of my favorite things about these projects. I love so very much the opportunity to share these important pieces of art with people in the hope that if we even just reach one person that didn't realize how powerful the art of music is to film, that they somehow appreciate it more, I feel like we've done our job on stage. So that's one of my favorite things. I love being able to share that and give people an opportunity to really experience this power of this art form. I imagine there's so many fans, I mean millions and millions of fans around the world of this franchise. I'd be surprised if there weren't some people at these shows, you know, that were dressed up as their characters. Only time will tell. You know, that's one of the other fun things is showing up at these venues and looking around and feeling the energy of the people that are sitting there, the excitement, the anticipation of seeing this film, the anticipation of hearing the music in this way. And I hope that people use this as an opportunity to have some fun as well.
Do you have a favorite song that you're really excited to conduct and see the orchestra perform?
There's so much music to this film. It really is quite like an opera. I mean, he wrote over 2 hours of music for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, and the ebb and flow of the emotion, the energy, the rhythm, the tempos, these all are very similar to kind of how opera works. And I think that film is in some ways our modern day opera. It's an extension of the opera that still continues in that art form just by itself. So I think that because of that, some of my favorite pieces are the ones that really have a great deal of emotional ups and emotional downs and great tempo variations. And so, you know, it's hard not to love. So fallen in love with Hedwig's theme. It's so magical. It's really just a wonderful tune. But as far as scenes, there's so many. There really is so many. I love the Quidditch match because of the mastery that is required from the orchestra to get that piece right. There are so many difficult passages musically in that will serve as a great challenge for all orchestras, and I am excited to share in that challenge and that collaboration with people. I love so very much the music that he created for Voldemort, especially at the very end, when they finally face one another, Harry and Voldemort, in
the
not-so-full form. It's gorgeous. I mean, it's actually quite beautiful. It might be sinister, but there's a sense of beauty. There's an adventure all over the film. So for me, there's really a wide palette of music to love, and I hope that orchestras and certainly the fans feel the same way.
Yeah, I would think music, and especially how you're describing it like an opera, is meant to tell a story. So when you're talking about Harry and Voldemort, I guess, meeting for the first time, that's kind of like the pivotal moment in the film, even though it's at the end. So I can understand that, how it's exciting.
I agree with what you're saying as far as the story. You know, you're right. I think all great music, regardless of what genre it was written for or what century it comes from, tells a story to us. You know, even some of the great music written for the court, you know, in the 16th and 17th centuries, even, you know, before that, tells a certain kind of story. And I think we now have that in a very visceral, meaningful way with film. I think that film as an art form has presented composers an opportunity to have a vehicle to share their music with the world over in a way that no composers had before film was in existence. You know, if you think about even opera in its heyday, the 19th century, the mid-19th century, you would reach thousands in a city, thousands and maybe perhaps multiple cities in Europe at the same time. But now all of a sudden we're reaching millions. Composers have this wonderful opportunity for their music to be heard around the world all simultaneously. So I think in that way, you know, we've come a long way in storytelling and music, and I love that film gives us that opportunity to tell story.
This kind of project requires a lot of practice and a lot of dedication. How hard is it to put together this kind of thing?
Well, I think that many of the challenges musically come from restoring the score. You know, these music scores are never intended to be performed this way, as you know. I mean, they're recorded in a way that you master each cue, you record maybe 3, 4, 5 takes of that cue, and you move on to the next one, and you move on to the next one, and you do that for a period of several days or a week or more, depending on how much music there is to record. But the composers, of course, never intend their music to be performed this way. So one of the challenges is first restoring the music in a way that things come in order. You're trying to restore as much as you can that it was represented in a way originally so that you're sharing it that way with audiences in a live setting. And with that particular challenge comes more challenge, you know, for the orchestra, and that all of a sudden now we have not one difficult cue, not three difficult cues, but many difficult cues back to back to back to back. So it becomes a great challenge for us on stage to maintain a sense of concentration so that this music is at all times perfectly synchronized to the film, that we have the same energy from cue to cue. So there's a lot of preparation that goes into these. Certainly something we've been working on for some time.
I can imagine. Why did you decide to do Harry Potter? It's kind of a very young franchise if you think about it.
Yeah, I mean, you could look at it as a young franchise. I think we could also look at it that there are actually very few franchises out there that have lasted this long. There's really only a handful in all of entertainment that, first of all, have this many films as part of their franchise. But perhaps more importantly, that the franchise still lives on, and it's still developing. It's still becoming larger and more involved and more special for people. So I think it's attracting more and more fans with each passing month. And what a wonderful opportunity for us all around the world to continue to live inside Harry's world and all of his friends and characters and emotions and these stories. It's almost never ending, and I love that about the Harry Potter franchise. You know, why this and not something else? Well, you know, I adore these scores. I adore these films. I think that each director and, you know, David Heyman and, you know, so many of the producers, the cinematographers, the costume designers, you know, the people on the art side, I mean, everyone contributed in such a special way, not the least of which was J.K. Rowling, who gave this all this to us from the beginning. And I adore the stories and I adore the music. And for me, those are the reasons that make all of the hard work and the challenges worth it at the end, because we're sharing these pieces of art with people in a very unique, new, and special way.
Do you hope to do maybe 2 through 8, all of the movie scores?
Well, the idea is to celebrate the entire series. I mean, we're launching with Harry Potter and Sorcerer's Stone, but this is the Harry Potter Film Concert Series. It's about the whole series.
Wow.
So as we cycle through them, we have a wonderful set of opportunities to present these unique scores in that way. But so excited to share this first score by John Williams, and Chris Columbus directed this film in such a very special way. So I think we're really all in for a treat. One of the more important things about this concert is you must see it to believe it. You know, you have to be there to really know what this is about. It's not something that you can watch at home. It's not something you can listen to on the radio. It's not something that, you know, you can watch on social online. It's something that you really do have to feel in person, see it in person to believe this magic. And I think that's one of the important things to pull away from this, the opportunity that exists to do this in person.
Thank you so much, Justin.
It's my pleasure. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Natalia Estrada in conversation with composer and conductor Justin Freer, conducting the music of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. That's at the Hollywood Bowl, July 6th. HollywoodBowl.com for more. This is 91.9 KVCR. As KVCR Arts continues, music and conversation with Maurice Williams. Maurice Williams and the Zodiacs are part of the lineup with The Legends of Doo-Wop Volume 2 coming to Upland July 16th. Tickets and information at affordablemusicproductions.com. Coming to Upland July 16th, it's The Legends of Doo-Wop Volume 2 with Eugene Pitt from the Jive 5, Jimmy Stevens of the Safaris, Shirley Alston Reed from the Shirelles, J.T. Carter, founder of the Crests, and Maurice Williams and the Zodiacs. I spoke with Maurice Williams a couple of weeks ago, and while they were known as the Zodiacs, eventually, due to a car by that name, they went through several names in the beginning, including with their first hit.
A little darling.
As we go through this conversation, there's going to be references to the Gladiolas, the Royal Charms, even the Zodiacs. We'll try to hit these names as they happened in your history, but going way back, can you tell us about the Junior Harmonizers? And this, I suppose, does go back to the beginning, huh?
Yeah, the very beginning. We were in church, and it was formed out of the church choir. We had got us a little quartet group. That's how that got started.
And then you became the Royal Charms at some point, so I would love to hear about Little Darling, not to be confused with the Neil Hefti jazz tune, Little Darling. I'd like to hear about you bluffing your way into an audition at the age of, what, 15 or 16 or so?
16. We had been listening to Nashville, Tennessee radio, WLAC, and they would be selling Little Baby Chicks and what have you, stuff like that on WLAC, and playing mostly rhythm and blues at the time. They were playing that, and the guy that was on, he was working for Ernie Young at Excello Records. And he would talk about them because they were sponsoring the show and playing the records and everything. So I gave Mr. Young a call and I told him that we would like to audition. He said, well, if you're ever in the area, you can call me and come to my studio and audition. I said, well, we'll be over there next month. We didn't have no job, no gig. He said, okay, we'll come by. So I called John Hall, the disc jockey. He said he would meet us and take us to the studio. My buddy Willie Jones had a beat up old Chrysler, four slick tires, not a spare. And we jumped in there, and William Massey, the guy that I wrote Little Darling for, to sing, because he was the lead singer at the time. His mother wouldn't let him go, so y'all crazy. She wouldn't let him go. Mm. But we went anyway and prayed all the way there. We got there and met John R. And he took us over to meet Ernie Young out at Nashville Records. We played him all the songs, and one of the guys said, well, why don't you play him the song you wrote for Bunchy? That was his nickname, Call Her Darling. So he's not here to sing it. They said, well, you wrote it, you can sing it. And I said, okay. I did that, and he loved it.
Nice.
And he said, let's spice it up. They put some castanets and make it like a, what you call it?
Like a calypso thing.
Yeah. And he said, chalk your lyrics. And so I did that, what he said, and it came out like that.
Nice.
And he loved it. And he took that and a few more. That's how I got started on that Little Darling.
Wasn't it also Ernie that convinced you guys to become the Gladiolas then at this point? Now we've got one of the first name shifts at this point.
Yeah, he did. He said because there's a lot of groups named the Royals, the Five Royals, and the Royal this, Royal that. And he'd say, he loved the flower Gladiola, and he named us the Gladiolas from that flower he loved.
Simple as that. Wow, nice.
Simple as that. Yep.
Well, with Little Darling, when the Diamonds took the song higher on the charts, I read that Ernie told you that since you were the writer of the song, all you should really care about, not so much is the other group's successes, rather that all you should care about is that it sells and gets played, and not whose version sells. And this gave you some early lessons. You were maybe only 16 or 17 maybe at this point?
I was 16, Yeah, he told me they started teaching me about publishing. And wherein he could have had the song, because all we wanted to do was make a record. He could have had the song and the royalties, the whole ballgame. But he didn't take it from me. He started teaching me about publishing and the business at an early age. And I never forget, he was a Christian-hearted man. And he did all that for me, and I still have my song to this day, you know.
To this day.
And the Diamonds version went to number two on the chart.
Mm-hmm.
As Dave Somerville used to say, because of that dang Elvis wouldn't move off the number one spot, so we got number two. And Gladys Ellis' version went up on the Rhythm and Blues chart, so get where it hit at.
That was great to see that going up on various charts. And it's also fantastic, kind of a rarity at this point, that Young did leave you with full rights as the songwriter, not trying to take it away. So that's
phenomenal. That wasn't happening back then.
Yeah. You earned a music scholarship to Allen University, but you had to turn it down. You were just actually performing too much. This would have really interrupted your career at this point.
Yeah, at the time I got the scholarship, we had a chance to go to L.A. and perform. So I talked to my mother and everybody in the family, and they said, go to L.A., you know, because that's your career. And they always worked me 100%, my family.
Beautiful.
So we didn't do the scholarship thing, and the principal that had gotten it for me, he said, you're making a mistake. He cursed me out. I was a young kid. So that music ain't never gonna go nowhere. I ain't looked back yet. He was mad because I didn't take him up on it, you know, and so I went to L.A., and then from there we've been going.
You guys ended up leaving Excello, and that meant that you had to give up the name the Gladiolas. And this could have been difficult for a group, but the quote here, and this is a striking quote, it's simple too, a name and a song. And so you were able to then become another group. This is, I think, interesting, how the name of the new group, how did the Zodiacs come about as a name for a group?
Well, first of all, Mr. Young said, well, since you're not going to sign with me anymore, I need to take my name back. it did that, the gladiolus. So we got there without a name. And so one particular time, we were in Bluefield, West Virginia, in our station wagon, and it broke down on us. And we had to go to a dealership. And in that dealership, my bass player went over and saw a car called the Zodiac. He came to me and said, "What do you think about the name Zodiac?" I said, "It's fine with me." So we took the name Zodiac off a car. Now I heard it was a Ford made in Europe somewhere. We took the name off that car and called ourselves Zodiac. And my manager at the time said, "Need to name it Maurice Williams and the Zodiac. So if that name thing come about again, they can't take your name. You can always have Maurice Williams." So we called him Maurice Williams and the Zodiac. And so that came about.
That's fantastic. I've talked with so many people who have been, like, you know, say part of the Coasters or the Drifters or a lot of those groups, and the name transferred from person to person to person. And
yeah,
but nobody's going to be Maurice Williams but you.
That's it.
Beautiful.
That's what he was talking about. So that was some good advice.
You were the Zodiacs at this point. I'd like to hear about that summer day recording in a Quonset hut on Shakespeare Road in Columbia. It's my understanding that the biggest hit for the Zodiacs was one of the last tracks recorded that day. Can we hear about this day?
Well, we had met two guys out of Columbia, South Carolina at a fraternity party, Phil Gernhardt and John McCullough. Well, Phil was later the manager for this group. Phil passed away, and so we were looking for songs and everything, so we came up with a bunch of songs, and a little girl, friend of the family, she said, "How about that song that had a high part in it?" She's about 9, and she was talking about steak. She said, "Oh, I like that." So I said, "Wow, if she liked it, other kids don't like it." So I pulled up Stay, and we started doing it, and we included that and the songs for Phil and John to carry to New York. So they carried to New York, and Hal Silver of Hal Ember Records, he liked Stay, and he sent it back, and he told us to make it short and sing it flat. Kind of hard to tell guys I was legal of that age to sing flat when we were trained to sing that key. But we did it. We made it short, and I sang as we could our tune. And then the part that's out of tune is the beginning of Stay, when it goes boom, 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 Stay. That
just
part
is
a little bit longer.
That's
the part that's out of tune. We had a jeweler spot, and they carried it back to him, and he loved it. and everything he said came true.
Wow. To have somebody say, "Hey, I love the song, except it's in tune. What can you do about this?"
Nobody would know that but musicians and people in the business.
Yeah.
You know.
Now, this was recorded later in the Zodiac's career, but didn't you actually write this one due to a date you had when you were about 15?
Yeah.
She had to meet her curfew, something like that?
Yeah, the same girl I was dating, her brother was to come by and pick her up at 10 o'clock that evening. So we were all friends of the family. So I tried to convince her to stay a little longer. She couldn't. He picked up and she left. The next morning I got up on the stage just a little bit longer.
Do you remember telling her things like, "Well, your mama won't mind and your daddy won't mind"?
I didn't tell her that. That was in my head. Won't you place your sweet lips
tonight? Yeah, well, maybe.
I was just sad. I did tell her, your parents won't mind because we were all friends of the family.
True.
But, you know, I put in a song like that.
Yeah. Notable lyrics. And there have been quite a few covers. Do you actually have any favorites? It's your own song, but there were some nice ones. The Hollies put that out. Also, Jackson Browne made it into a part of...
My favorite was the Four Seasons.
Ah, right, yeah.
Their arrangement.
Oh, yeah.
I was crazy about that.
I read, this is an interesting bit of trivia, at 1:36 long, Stay is the shortest recording ever to reach number one on the Billboard Hot 100. When Stay was included on the soundtrack for the film Dirty Dancing in 1987, You still have rights to the song today. So when they were getting ready to put that onto the soundtrack, was this a thing where they had to contact you? It was just done through your management? How does something like that work?
The publisher called me.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we have a chance to stay on a movie. And he had been in some more movies, Little Darling also. And they just said, what do you think? I said, well, let's go for it. You know, and it says a low-budget movie, it probably won't do nothing, but at least your song will be in it. So we put it in there, and to me, the musical soundtrack of Dirty Dancing made the whole movie.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because, I mean, Patrick knows that great actors and dancing, but those songs, man, they were something.
There's a song called May I, and it did get released, and it did become a million seller, but didn't it almost sink with the ship for a moment when it went to the original publisher?
Yeah, DJ Records, Marshall Seahorn down in New Orleans. Yeah, what happened was we released it on VJ Records, and soon as they released it, the company went out of business.
A couple days later, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then he had to put it on his label, which is called D. Sue Records, and we released it like that. That's what happened.
So then it did get airplay through that. And you did say that later you made it shaggable. And this is referencing not Austin Powers, but Carolina Beach music. Can you talk to me a little bit about Carolina Beach music? It's not such a familiar term, but it is a recognizable thing if you're in that area.
Yeah, in the area. First time I heard the word beach music was in 1964. And that's when Maya was out. And the shag thing. And I saw him do it, and I said, oh, this is a remake of the Jitterbug, which it was. The dance, the Jitterbug. That's what the shag is, the same thing, slowed down.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It was great.
So to redo the tune, May I, to make it more shaggable, you talked about, what, a walking bass line. Did you re-record the song?
Oh, lately, yeah. It's on the album, Maurice Williams and his Zodiac 50-year anniversary album, with a walking bass.
I did read also that you recorded some solo stuff. Is there a non-Zodiac Maurice Williams album out there, or were these recorded as singles?
I think they were singles.
Because the Zodiacs, it seems, never really stopped, even at some point. Didn't you expand the group to some 9 people with a horn section as a permanent lineup?
Yeah. They all came directly out of a high school band, with a band I played the trombone. And the marching band, and the concert band. So I was in love with horns anyway. And I picked up the piano also, and I played by ear to the day on the keyboard. So yeah, I did it, and my band leader was a music teacher all his life, Calvin McKinney, where he passed away, and he had the horn section for me. It was a good song, about we had maybe 3 horns, but it was great. It was, the guys were so good.
Well, now, Maurice, I've spoken with various doo-wop era groups, and they all had different things to say about the British invasion and how it affected their careers, or even whether or not it did. Some folks were like, you know what, we borrowed from each other, no difference. But you, in one form or another of the Zodiacs, have kept performing through the years. How did the so-called British invasion affect you, if at all?
We made money on it.
Oh, yeah?
What we did, when the Beatles came, we went and got us some wigs and some cardboard guitars, and we pretended we were the Beatles. We had a Beatles act, and people loved it. We heard this black guy singing, I want to build your head. And when we got to the ooh part of ooh, we would shake our heads and the wigs would go there. People loved it, so we, you know, I said, yeah, we did it together.
Oh, my God, I had not heard of this one. So I've got to hear about the inception of this idea. I mean, so what, they're on the Ed Sullivan show.
On Ed Sullivan.
So was it after that national television appearance that you guys were like, okay, we got to get some wigs. I got a great idea. Or
yeah, after they got so popular here in the U.S. Yeah, they said, wow, these guys are popular. So, and I liked every song they did. You know, I really did, and still do. And so when they did all that and got that popular, we said, we're going to get popular with them.
Oh.
So got us some wigs.
That is a riot.
And it went over great, man. The college kids loved it. They loved it.
I hadn't read that anywhere. That is beautiful. That made the conversation right there.
Yeah, man. Like Beatles.
Oh, my gosh.
I came up with acts for the group to do. We had one called Please, Mr. Custer.
Please, Mr.
Remember,
Cusper.
Ms. Cusper?
Yeah.
We did it at the Apollo. Not the Beatles, but we did this particular act called Please, Mr. Cusper, I Don't Want to Go.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a guy, Wally Bennett, may he rest in peace, he passed. We would be singing, Please, Mr. Cusper, I Don't Want to Go. And it's in there where an arrow shot out and hit the guy. So Wally Bennett was playing the part that got hit by the arrow. And when he got hit by the arrow, the drummer went, pow! And he acted that part, man, had the whole... We all laughed. We laughed with the orchestra because he played it so perfect. He played it so perfect.
Oh,
man, that was fun. That was one act. And then we had another one called the baseball act where we play baseball on the stage singing.
Really?
Then when the Beatles came along, that was the moneymaker.
Wow.
That was something.
That is fun. This is stuff that
yeah,
I never
man,
heard.
Yeah, fun with it. And then we played Ray Charles, Hit the Road, yeah.
Yeah.
And Don't You Come Back. Wally would put on a pillow on his dress and come out with a dress on and that pillow under that. And he would be singing, Hit the Road, Jack, you ain't no good. No more, no more, no more, no more. You know, and they went crazy again. But I was doing a lot of acts.
Oh.
These were for nightclubs.
Before we wrap up here, I was looking at some videos and just whatever you can find on YouTube. Who is Luke Labosa? A young man that you performed Stay With. I mean young, like 10 years old, a high falsetto voice.
Oh, little Luke.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did that 2 months ago. He would come to our church and sing, and he had just a nice little cute voice. I decided to take him in the studio and let him sing the high part on stage. And we did that, and it worked. First, we discovered him in church. I played for the church choir, the men's choir, and he was in church singing, and my guitar player found him, really, and brought him to my attention. And we produced him with the Stay thing, and it okay. Well, that was great.
Sure is.
Mm-hmm. He's good.
Stay with me, baby. Stay with me, baby. Come on, stay, baby. Daddy don't mind. Mommy don't mind. Stay with me, baby.
When I get copies, I'm going to get it out to you called Hell to the Panthers.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, man. They had been in business maybe 4 or 5 years, and I came with the song Hell to the Panthers. And I recorded it in Nashville. That was, umpteen years ago, in the 80s at least. I wanted to release it since they're so popular now. And I couldn't find a copy, so I had to record it over again, which we did. Because on the intro, I wanted to put on there, pounding, pounding, keep on pounding, pounding, pounding. And then we'll go into the song.
Mm.
I wanted to add that anyway. So it's good I recorded it over again. So there should be copies out in the next couple of weeks or so.
Excellent. That is something
it'll be on the internet. Yeah, man.
Also, I guess then, just in a few weeks then, as I mentioned, this fantastic concert that you guys are part of the lineup.
Now, I know Shirley is on the show with the Shirelles.
That's right. Shirley with the Shirelles.
Who else is on there?
The Jive 5, J.T. Carter from the Crests.
Oh, the Crests, yeah.
Yeah, that's okay, probably going to be one of the next biggies.
That's wonderful.
This has become a very, very popular thing out here. And they've been packing these, whether it's a school, and then they move up to a bigger venue and a bigger venue. They keep on packing the house every time.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll have fun.
That's
I grew up with my audience. We're the same age now.
Yeah, but then you've got, but then their kids, like myself, I'm 50, and so my age will be there as well.
This little girl, you never forget, Dirty Dancing came out. We're doing an outdoor concert, and after the show, we were doing a meet and greet thing. She came up to me and said, Mr. Williams, can I shake the hand of the man that shook Patrick Swayze's hand? Sure. I said, but I didn't shake his hand. Never met him before. But I'd be glad to shake your hand. It's going to get the story right. and shook her hand. And after that, I said, we got a new generation. And sure enough, we do. Thank God for Dirty Dancing. That turned the table.
That's right.
Dirty Dancing, yeah.
It's got the next wave coming in, and hopefully these folks will be bringing their kids into the picture, and we're just not going to let this stuff go.
Keep it going.
Maurice, I really appreciate your time and your memories. This has been fantastic.
Oh, man, yeah. I've got it covered. I enjoy talking to you.
All right, and you too. Bye-bye.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Maurice Williams and the Zodiacs are part of an all-star lineup with Legends of Doo-Wop Volume 2 in Upland July 16th, along with Eugene Pitt from the Jive 5, Jimmy Stevens of the Safaris, J.T. Carter of the Crests, and Shirley Austin Reeves from the Shirelles. That's in Upland July 16th. Information and tickets at affordablemusicproductions.com. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Maurice Williams, as well as to author James Rollins. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Natalia Estrada, Rick Dulock, Sula Ahmad, Isabella Salinas, Emmanuel Rogers, and General Manager Alfredo Cruz. Beyond the music of Maurice Williams and the Zodiacs, and a few of the themes from John Williams' score for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, behind us now. For example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can find past KVC Arts programs at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.